And also on the set from Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, we got my man J.Ru the Damager. Yo, tell him why you're the man.
I'll tap your jaw. You probably heard it before. Step to the Bentley mic. I prove my word is law. Drugstore work more. Don't rhyme vendor. Not partial to beat the chief ambassador. Niggas get mad cause they can't score. Like a Wild West flick, they wish to shoot up my door. But I incite to riot. Don't even try it. Bust up chumps who crab kids. Keep quiet. Like I said before, I tap jaws, snatch whores. Kill suckers in wars. Pick a style you said was yours. Money grip, wanna flip, but your fish. House the mic like your hooker and did tricks on a bitch. Dirty rotten scoundrel, and my name is J.Ru. Utilizing my tools in 92. MC step up in mobs to defeat us when we rock knots and got rocks like Norm Peterson. Lots of fun, lots of fun, lots of beers. Got the skills, Greeno, so I always get cheers. Troop on like a trooper, no tears but fears. I'ma get mines cause the crew will get theirs. Cut you up like Edward Scissorhands. You know the program, I'm the motherfucking man. Fucking man.
Play that song, and I like what you did with the editing there. It's funny because you're playing it through. Oh, I gotta yell in here.
You're playing
it through like the whole first way through, and like the guru definitely does his thing on the track, as it were, and then comes in, and it was that Little Dap, right? He's going, and I'm sitting here listening to him. I'm like, damn, I wish he could just skip Little Dap, and then like right as he said that, right as I was thinking that, then you're like this. This guy sucks. But I like what you did there. You just went straight to J.Ru, which is the highlight of that song. So
cut you up like Edward Scissorhands?
You know the program.
How old are you in 92? I was 17 in 92.
The producer was
like
8.
15.
Really? You were 15? 92?
Yeah.
So I was probably like 16, and then I turned... Because the time of the year it was. Yeah. I think the song came out, I was 16. I might have been a senior. Jeez, dude. It's crazy, man. Crazy.
Yes, it is.
We're getting old, Poppy.
Yeah, well, that I've been figuring out for a while, especially as I've been trying to, you know, play a little bit of basketball this summer. But I was actually decent yesterday.
Yeah?
Got it down to 3-on-3, and I was able to make some moves.
Well, you can always make moves.
Nah, I don't have the agility I once had, so it's like it's a lot of, like, barreling in, and like opening up the floor with 3-on-3 instead of 5-on-5, I was able to do a lot more. So it was encouraging for once. I actually got some points up.
You got to put some calisthenics, see?
Yeah. I did. I went into, well, I didn't do calisthenics, but I exercised.
You exercised?
I did.
you ran your mouth?
I feel vigorous.
You feel vigorous? Let's see how vigorous you feel while we do this podcast.
All right, that sounds good.
So I don't have to carry you like J.Ru has to carry Little Dap. You're the Little Dap of our podcast.
A lot of people have to carry Little Dap. I guess if I was going to talk about something that was energizing, I guess I'd have to start with the Beast in the East.
Yeah, that's all I want to talk about. There's something I want to talk about first.
Okay, well... I guess let's talk about what you want to talk about first.
We will, because I want to get your, take on this. So, I didn't realize this match was the main event until it was over, and I was like, "Oh, Raw's over." What did you think of the second John Cena and Cesaro match? Did you like it?
I think the match, the match is still good, but there's just it's interesting. Trying to figure out like. I would like to be as impartial towards Cena as I possibly can, despite the fact I know I'm biased against him, right? And I just feel like there's just certain little things surrounding the match that bother me, I think. Like things happening within the match. The match itself is good.
Either it bothers you or you...
It does bother me, but the match in itself is still a good match. I mean, they perform well. But yeah, there's a lot of things that bother me about the match. I'm guessing you didn't like the match too much.
I liked the first match. I think the second match, anything they do in the second match, I really think that it's, I mean, cause I already know what's coming. Fool me once or what, how do you do it? How did, George W. Bush said it? I mean, the whole thing, the first match was good. The second match, okay, yeah, I can watch it, but I already know the outcome of the match, and the whole thing is the biggest problem I have is Like someone said, someone that I know in the social media verse was saying that John Cena has been the MVP during this whole time of his open challenge, and I guess that would be I could kind of agree to that if I didn't have to hear him talk all the time. I mean, if I don't need to hear the same. I mean, it's the same John Cena promo over and over again, which of course I get tired of, but. The first Cesaro match was good. I mean, I knew Cesaro was going to lose, right? You know, Kevin Owens come in and break it up and all that stuff. But it just kind of seems to me it had a lot of Dolph Ziggler-ism in it, where Cena faced Dolph Ziggler like maybe two or three times, and Ziggler, of course, carried the match and kind of buried him in the process. I just feel that let's do it this way, right? So... John Cena's the top guy in WWE. Can we agree on this? I mean, he's the top draw in WWE, right? He is their guy, right?
Okay.
I mean, we can agree on that, right?
I'll agree that he's their guy.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, I'm not saying that he's the top guy. I'm saying right. That company wise, he's their top guy. The company backs this guy 150%. He is their flagship.
He's the face of the franchise.
Exactly.
Okay.
So and let's compare it to Tanahashi in New Japan Pro Wrestling.
Okay.
And you look at the difference where Tanahashi wins a lot, but he also loses a lot too. And Tanahashi, whoever he's fighting, the other guy isn't doing all the work, and Tanahashi just isn't like laying back to get his spots in. I mean, Tanahashi can go against anybody and put on a good match. I'll give that to Tanahashi. I'm not a fan of Tanahashi. I don't like Tanahashi's character. I don't like kind of his shtick over there.
You're a fan of his work, though.
But I'm a fan of his work. He's a great worker.
Right.
Where John Cena, I can't even say he's a great worker. I mean, I think he can wrestle, but everybody else makes him look good. Every single guy. I mean, you talk about like all the great John Cena matches. It was never a case where you're sitting there going like, well, John Cena really made this guy look like $1 million. It's more of a case where the guy makes John Cena look like $1 million. And it's just kind of, that's what the problem I had with this second Cesaro match was that, yeah, you know what, it's a great match. Okay, I'm not going to take that away. But the whole thing is, don't give John Cena a standing ovation at the end. Or John Cena is in no position to stand up and thank the crowd after that. He should pick Cesaro up and thank Cesaro and shake this guy's hand in the middle of the ring and put him on his shoulders a la... Bad luck, Fale or whatever. It's kind of like, to me, it's kind of like a slap in the face for any Cesaro fan. This guy has put any position they put in Cesaro, the guy has succeeded. Not company wise, but he's been able to show what he can do. And here he is, he's doing the job for John Cena, and John Cena's getting the rub again. I mean, it shouldn't be that way. The top guy shouldn't be getting rubbed from other guys. The top guy should mentor other people. I guess I'm still in this mode of... The one thing, I listened to the Ric Flair podcast, and he did it with Lex Luger. And one thing that Lex Luger said, and it was kind of a... I mean, Ric Flair's podcast is kind of a waste of time, because he's not asking the guy questions. It's not like it's a Stone Cold podcast, right? Stone Cold... Totally, like makes the guy whoever the guest is on the show makes him the star, right? Ask him questions, all this stuff. Flair just kind of tells a story that they do back and forth, which is fine because that's Ric Flair. But the one thing that Luger did say, which I've been saying for a long time, Luger said you knew how to make stars out of people. He's like I talk about this thing all the time. He's like, you knew how to make us look great. He's like, you had a match with Sting, you set Sting up for life. You had a match with me, you set me up for life. Cena, I just don't get it. I don't know if it's ego with this guy. I don't get how other people can make him look great all the time, and he comes back the next week and just spews vitriol. No, I mean I spew vitriol. He comes back every week.
You're spewing vitriol right now.
I know it's an inside joke.
Yes, the thing.
Yeah, very good. But then he comes back and says how great he is or how great the fans are. It's like. Your body of work is based off of... You step on other people to make yourself look good. And I'm supposed to sit there and listen to a promo about you and get behind your corner when you don't make anybody look good. You have other people make you look good.
Well, to defend Cena slightly here, I didn't watch it, but I know afterwards through Twitter, there's a lot of people saying that there's like a dark promo, and he like kind of brought Cena, he brought Cesaro in and like really like propped up Cesaro to the crowd after they went off the air. So at least,
well, then show that,
right? No, I agree, but I'm just saying he apparently did that. I didn't listen to it. I don't know exactly what he said, so I'm not going to go into the details. But that's what like all the reports were. So like at least I'll give him that. He went ahead and did that. So let's see.
I mean, what's the difference between him and Hulk Hogan? Because Hulk Hogan did the same thing. Hulk Hogan, whoever his adversary was, he would kind of. I mean, Hogan picked out guys that he could beat up and make himself look good. I mean, what's the difference though? I mean, is it because we're older, or I mean, what's the difference now?
I still want to address a lot of the stuff you said, but really quickly, I mean, to me, the big difference is Hogan had mic skills and Hogan had like legitimate charisma, and that's I think what it comes down, because I think you could draw a ton of parallels. Cena is a much better worker than Hogan ever was, but drawing the parallels between the two, I think the thing that sets Hogan apart was like he could always talk, he could always get on the mic and cut a good promo, and like even in an age where it was kind of more cartoonish, like he could still like he could still kind of appeal to adults, not everything just like being a super corny. I mean, it was a cornier time, but it didn't feel as bad when he was doing it as what Cena does, but. Yeah, I mean, you addressed a ton of stuff there with your little discussion of that match. I think I want to start with the good stuff, right? So one thing I like, they actually gave it the time that it needed to be. They gave it a full 30 minutes, and that's how you have, you know, you give enough time to tell a legitimate story in a match. And it makes Cesaro, you know, he's able to really show what he can do and look good. Agree with what you say. I mean, yeah, every time people start talking about these great matches that Cena has, it's always with some guy that's like a five-star worker, right? And so for me, that's always going to be a little bit of the kind of like the caveat when you're talking about, like, you know, because people, there's almost like a counter side coming back supporting John Cena right now, like online, and like seems like a lot of people are more supportive of him, more positive with him, saying, oh, this guy's a really good worker. Yeah, if you put him in a match with a great worker, then he can work a good match. Okay, that's already established. I think the biggest issue I have, and you know, I know who's going to win just like you, so that doesn't necessarily bother me, but looking at those two guys wrestle, and you see the last few weeks, they're trying to have John Cena do all these moves that he's never done before, and he's botching like 75% of them. And they're making this real point to say, like, oh, he's so innovative on offense, and he's doing all this stuff and this and that. It's like they're giving him all this freedom to do all these things that he's not even good at. And at the same time, you got Cesaro, who they literally took away everything he had just because he was getting so over. And it's like, that's what I don't understand, what people that are really watching closely, I don't understand why they don't see that. It's like they're gonna give him these like flipping power bombs that he can't do, and this stupid fucking springboard thing, and everyone's gonna go all crazy over it. While with Cesaro, he had like legitimate moves pulling him out of nowhere, offense that nobody seemed for. He's not coming through and saying, "Well, Steve Austin did a stunner, so I can't just do a regular stunner. Let me jump off a rope." Like it's just fucking dumb, right? And Cesaro's coming out with a swing. It's like a 30-year-old move that nobody cares about. European uppercut. It's like that move's been in play for quite a while, but he's throwing it like no one's really thrown it before. And not just that, like at a regular standing European, but from any angle you can think of, top rope, springboard off the middle rope, turning a European uppercut into a finisher, right? Like all the stuff that he's doing is like really what has been like really, really
innovative.
Yes, real legitimately innovative. And you're going to go around and just, like, kind of slurp John Cena the whole way through. And then, and just kind of let him, you can do whatever you want, but, you know, this guy, oh, that's a pretty good move. We better take it away because people are starting to like you too much. And then to back, kind of go piggyback off what you said, you're talking about the crowd eating it up, but specifically, like,
I'm losing respect by the show with this Chicago crowd. It's like, I used to think like Chicago was kind of one of the better crowds in the country for Raws when they came through. But the last couple, three times just been really kind of disappointing me in terms of like, I think they're supposed to be like more knowledgeable fan base than what they are. And they're just like eating it up with the spoon. And it's embarrassing for these guys in my eyes.
I think it's embarrassing overall. I think the U.S. wrestling crowd just really, and this is kind of, if you don't have anything else to say about the Cena Cesaro match, you bring up that they had 30 minutes to tell a story. There isn't a story. I mean, the story is that you know Cesaro's going to lose, and that's the story. And it doesn't matter what you put in the middle of it. It just it doesn't do anything for me. The first match, I knew Cesaro was going to lose. I knew Cesaro wasn't going to win. I knew he wasn't going to win the title, and I know that Cesaro wasn't going to win the title a second time. But the whole thing is, it just kind of seems a case where John Cena lost to, or John Cena beat Cesaro the first time because Kevin Owens got involved, and it just seems to me that now John Cena has to beat him clean. And it throughout the whole match, you're having high spot here, high spot there. Cesaro is really wowing John Cena, and it's to the point where I mean it's kind of the same thing we talked last week about the announcers and how the announcers are kind of ruining the product, especially when it comes to John Cena. Well, you know, JBL saying, like, you know, John Cena's the best of all time. It's like, come on, dude, really? I mean, JBL, you've been a wrestler. I mean, you've wrestled, you've been around great wrestlers. I mean, you've seen great wrestlers. For you to say that John Cena is the best ever, it's like, what are you trying to sell me here? Tell me the truth. I mean, here's the whole thing. It's like, Lex Luger fought Booker T right before Booker T was starting to take off. I mean, he had a program with Benoit. Benoit was definitely second tier. He had singles programs with Fit Finlay. Fit Finlay was definitely second tier in the company. And then he fights Lex Luger, who is supposedly first tier, even though Lex Luger is probably in actuality like third tier, right? But the whole thing is, Lex Luger has a match with Booker T, and he beats Booker T, but Luger does the job for Booker T in terms of making Booker T, like giving Booker T a chance. They interview Lex Luger after the match, which is a travesty unto itself, because if you ever heard a Lex Luger promo or interview, it's bad. But the very first thing that Luger says, he's like, Booker T something else, isn't he? I mean, he's like Booker T has a bright future as a singles, something along that lines. And then Booker T takes off. So the whole thing is, you have the only guy that I can, and I hate being this guy in every single podcast, but the only guy that you can kind of point at, the two guys maybe, but they're already established, they're already made. One was CM Punk, the other was Brock Lesnar. But he's had matches with Ziggler. He buried Ziggler. Ziggler had great three matches with him. Whatever it is, he buries Damian Sandow, when Sandow on the mic was probably one of the maybe the top in the top 10 guys on the mic, and at that time in WWE, he buries that guy with the Money in the Bank. He buries Bray Wyatt, and the thing, I think Kevin Owens is going to win, but I mean, we'll see. Yeah, but that's the whole problem, is that Cesaro's not going to, he's not going to get a run after this.
Yeah, I mean that's the big difference between, like, well, there's a lot of differences, but you posed a question earlier about Tanahashi versus John Cena, and you're saying, like, you know, Tanahashi wins a lot of matches, but he loses a lot of matches. Kind of like Patrick Ewing makes a lot of money, but he spends a lot of money. The thing with Tanahashi that you see is, when he loses for a purpose, and the guy that he loses to goes somewhere. And that's what you're seeing, that John Cena, that never happens. And what you're saying, like, in terms of putting somebody over, right? Like, there's, like, I guess there's kind of two senses of a word, right? Like, you could say, did he put Cesaro over in that, you know, he had a good match and Cesaro got to do a lot of stuff? Sure, yeah, that happened. But is he elevating Cesaro? Is he putting Cesaro into a new tier in the company? And the question is no. And that's the problem with John Cena. None of these guys that he goes through, Rusev's another guy he didn't mention, just popping off the top of my head. None of these guys ever got elevated. The only guy I could think of that really got elevated by ever having a feud with John Cena, and I don't even know if my timeline's accurate on this, is probably Edge.
Edge and Randy Orton. Because him and Randy Orton went back and forth, and Randy Orton would...
But I might argue, like... Randy Orton was already established. Yeah, he was already established. Like Edge would be the only guy in that, you know, Edge, he had to kind of go from being that tag team guy to the mid-card guy, and then work his way from mid-card guy to world champion
status. But you can make the argument, too, that Edge works with Hogan, and I think that him working with Hogan elevated him up into that upper level. I mean, you're talking about probably the second biggest draw in the business, working with Edge. I think that had a little bit to do with it as well.
Maybe so. That's what I said. I'm not completely sure on what the timeline was, but I know, like, there was a really good feud for a couple of years there with Edge and John Cena that I think, coming out of it, I'd say Edge had been put onto a level that, you know, wasn't sure that he was going to get to before he went into that feud. And that's really the only time that I think you can say that.
I think you're grasping at straws with it. You know, I mean, I think Edge was... I'm not disagreeing with what you're saying. I disagree with the idea of it. You like that one? I think Edge was already kind of there. I think he was kind of the... John Cena maybe was the final straw to really put him in the stratosphere.
Maybe so. But that, like, that's the best example. Like, there's no clear-cut cases where you can say, like, oh, John Cena took this guy... that, you know, people thought might be able to do it and put this guy and made him a star.
I mean, let's do this. I'd rather compare John Cena to Bret the Hitman Hart. I kind of feel, you know, Hitman got over more on people than usual. I mean, I think he... But you look at the two guys that he made, and, you know, if you can say that he made them... I think, you know, of course, I think he did the job for Austin, even though he beat him. But it was done in such a way where Austin the next week took off. And I think the other guy that he kind of made too, even though this guy had all the talent, was like a Shawn Michaels. So, I mean, he did the job for Shawn Michaels all the time. And I don't think very good. We caught a gnat. Yeah, you remember the Aesop fable with the gnat on the bull and... And that's like, oh, I hope you don't mind me hanging on your ass for 2 hours. And then the bull was like, I didn't even notice you were there. So kind of like the same thing with that gnat over there. He made it on the podcast. But the difference is that Bret couldn't talk. John Cena can't talk. But Bret was a great ring general. And he could put on a great match. Even though I'm not a big fan of his matches, I respect what he did in the ring. Kind of like the same line as a Tanahashi. I'm just going like, why are you doing it dark? I mean, if he's going to bring out Cesaro, well, let him do it. You know, it's another case too where I think Cena is the type where he's the guy of the company, but he doesn't really have any pull in the company. I think he has pull for all the negative reasons. I think he holds people back where instead of trying to make the business better, it just really seems where... It, you know, and then I can compare him back to Hogan because Hogan held a lot of people back, but Hogan had the charisma to do it. I mean, Hogan could stick around for a lot longer than he should have in the WWF because, and even in WCW, because he could carry a show. And you tuned in every week, whether he was a face or a heel, to see what he was going to do next. Cena doesn't have that, and all he's doing is he's just burying people left and right. And then he's coming on the mic saying how great he is and how great we are, and the shtick is old. The second Cesaro and John Cena match sucked. It sucked. I don't care what it was. It sucks. And it sucks because it doesn't do anything. It's just like, it's a way to make John Cena look good. And I'm not on that train anymore. I've never been on that train. I'm not going to be on the train now.
The match doesn't suck, John. The idea of the match sucks.
No, the match sucked, dude.
It's an enjoyable watch, but in terms of
what it's... It wasn't an enjoyable watch. It wasn't for me.
Because you knew what was going to happen in the end.
I knew that he was quick to claim Cesaro's name and his fame. Yeah, Cesaro deserves a lot more than what he's getting, especially when he's had the two best matches on Raw for probably the past 2 months, and he's not getting any credit for it. It's just a way to boost up John Cena.
Yeah, it's just and then it's frustrating to have to hear, like, you know, you mentioned JBL, which is on a broadcast, whatever, but even like guys that, you know, you would expect, like Ric Flair, if they catch Ric Flair in a WWE interview, start saying how John Cena is like right up there too. And it's like, these guys, they know better, right? There's no way I feel that they believe what they're saying, but they have
But they get paid,
right? And that's the thing that kind of sucks. Like, you're losing a lot of like the what made wrestling good, and a lot of people having to pretend that certain things are the way they are, just to satisfy the egos of the company. Even yeah, so. That's about all I got to say about that, man.
Okay.
I understand why you're frustrated, but and able to just sit and watch the match, yeah, it's a good match.
I'll never be able just to sit and watch a John Cena match. Whenever I watch a John Cena match, I want to see that guy lose. I mean, that's the way that I'm watching this guy now. I've had to sit through all this guy saying the same stuff over and over again, having the match where he's going to win and kick out of everything. I'm never going to sit back and enjoy a John Cena match. And I don't think I've ever sat back and enjoyed a John Cena match. Every match that I've enjoyed with John Cena, he's lost. And that's a problem unto itself. I have no problem. I have no vendetta against John Cena. It's not like I'm sitting here going, like, I hate John Cena. I'm going to start my own club. I mean, if I wanted like 10,000 followers on Twitter, I could start a Twitter account right now saying John Cena sucks. And I could get a ton of followers and all this stuff. I have no problem with John Cena. I just have a problem that after 11 or 12 years that he's been in the business now, he still doesn't get it. He does the same thing. He's in a position of power to make the company better, especially since he has no flipping competition whatsoever. And it's just more of the same. It's like he's like the superhero. wrestling isn't about a superhero. You talk about the Chicago crowd, I brought the U.S. crowd. I think the U.S. crowd, I think they're marks unto themselves. I think that. They want to be smarks. They want to kind of control the tempo of what the wrestling pulse is, but they're sheep. And the reason why I say this is because now we can get in to the Beast in the East or whatever it's from. You look at that show was a great show, and we can get into it right now. But the thing I like best about that, granted from the matches. A large part of the reason why I like that show was because the Japanese crowd actually knows what the heck they're doing, and they can be fans for certain people, but they appreciate good wrestling, and they appreciate good stories, and we can jump in right now. Chris Jericho versus the man that Charisma forgot. I thought that if you talk about like matches of the year, that to me is on par of being a candidate for Match of the Year. I thought that was a great match, and the best thing about that match was that there was no roles in that match. It was just two guys going out there. Jericho played the heel that Japan knows him for, and I think he came out even better. I mean, yeah, he played the heel role, but people liked him because he was playing the heel role. I think there's so many levels to that match between Neville and Jericho. There's so many good storytelling elements within that. I thought, even from like Neville being in the center of the ring, Jericho's outside. You can't do no weak suicide dive in Japan. You have to do something.
Right.
And Neville does a back, like a sideways flip onto Jericho. It's like, how can you guys can't be like that in the U.S.? I mean, that was a good show. That was a good match. And I kind of wanted to get your take on Neville and Jericho as well.
Yeah, no, I thought that was the best match of the night. And it was funny, I was seeing the Meltzer ratings, and he actually had like the Balor and Owens match as rated a little bit higher. But I for my money, that was the best match on the card. And you know, like Jericho pulled out everything, right? And I think that was really good about it. But he really allowed Neville to get all his shit in too. And like I said, I mean, I'm not really that high on Neville. I mean, I think he's coming along pretty nicely. I think he's doing a good job of putting on good matches. I think he's going to be definitely limited by his ability to speak or lack thereof. But in terms of what he does in the ring, it's good. And when you can match him up with a guy that physically he matches well with, like Chris Jericho.
Not only that, but a guy that's knows how to tell a story and knows how to wrestle.
Yeah.
I mean that was a Japanese match.
Yeah. Well, there's that, but I mean,
no, there's more. I mean, that's no. What. It, I mean,
yeah.
You know, well, I know.
Yeah, but I'm saying like, you know, I've been seeing a lot of say like Neville and Sheamus or Wade Barrett, and it's like he should never
two. I mean, that's what I'm trying. That's the whole thing. It's right. Like, it's not so much that Jericho matches up well with Neville. It's more of a case where I do get what you're saying. He's facing the bigger guy. He's limited what he can do, but Jericho, to me, in that match, was much bigger than Sheamus. He was as big as, he was as dominant as, like, say, Andre the Giant was. I mean, just the way he carried himself during that match, just playing the heel, people start cheering for Jericho, you know, because they remember him from way back when. They appreciate him. He does the "Come on, baby" and stuff, and he did that with he did that when he was in Japan. I mean, he stole that from the faction that was there before with Jado Gido, and then the wrestler that passed away. I forget the name of the group.
Was that the one that he claimed he was part of, that it was debatable if he ever actually was?
Yeah, I mean, I think he was there for like maybe two shows with them or something like that. That's besides the point, because we'll say it and nobody else will be like, oh, what? But when the crowd would start to cheer him, because they realized, like, hey, like, Jericho still has it. Jericho would do a heel move right away, like, you know, he would stomp on Neville's head when he was down, and all of a sudden the Japanese crowd is booing him again. And what I really liked about that match was that I thought Neville was going to get his flaming arrow, whatever it's called in there, right? The broken arrow, or broken arrow is probably like Neville's career with that movie with Travolta and Slater, Christian Slater.
Could have been.
Yeah. So you know, so that last time he's on the top, he's on the rope, because he tried three times. So the third time he's trying, it's like, okay, he's going to get it in now. And then Jericho puts his knees up and puts him in the lion tamer and puts him in the old school lion tamer. Yeah. And the thing, I'm watching this match and it's I always kind of go by a match where I haven't seen a WWE match where I think the only one I think the Owens, the first Owens and John Cena one, I was kind of like, you know, there'd be a couple moves I'm like, yeah, I'm like pretty much like putting my hands up in the air, just like going, God, dude, like, what is that? Yeah. Well, Jericho and Neville probably had about three or four spots around doing that. And then that last one where he puts the knees up and he puts him in the old school lion tamer, man, I started doing the old Chris Jericho theme music for WCW the second that he put it in. It was just a good time. It's like, that's the matches that I remember. And the worst thing about it was that Jericho, over the past 2-3 years, whenever he's come back in WWE, he hasn't been allowed to have that type of match. He's always had to have the WWE style type match, where this was a match where I really felt that this is a Jericho that you saw probably 15, 20 years ago, and then I saw 15, 20 years ago. That's a Jericho that I remember. And how come he can't, whenever he comes back, how come he can't do that when he, instead of trying to put someone over, he can actually win some or lose some as well?
Yeah, but then I'll also say, you know, Neville is a far superior talent to Fandango. So who knows? You know, I think they maybe need to be a little more selective of when and how they're going to use Jericho, and don't just say, well, we need to get this guy over anyway, anyhow, so, you know, you're going to lose to Fandango. When he came back the first time, when it was really obvious he was just coming back to put guys over, it was Ziggler. And the program was really good because you had a talent that could match it and someone that, you know, he could learn what he needed to learn from Jericho and then rise up to the next level because of it. Fandango was completely forced. It's just like, well, we need some. I mean, we're bringing you back, and we got you for this WrestleMania season, and this is the guy we want to get over, so here we go.
But I think Jericho has a small part picking the guy, too, though.
I think he does, but I don't know. I'm sure he has some say, because, yeah, he does have creative control on whether he's going to come back or not, right?
Well, let's not get into that. Let's talk about the match. I mean, that's...
Well, I mean, I don't think there's much more to say about the match, but... To what your point was about the crowd, the thing that I noticed was, like, there's times where they're very quiet, right? And I think that was part of what leads to let this match be what it is, because, like, and I can't even remember, it was this match and it was even the Owens match, because Owens worked the crowd really well too. But there's times where it's quiet and they're just kind of sitting there, and then you can hear very clearly, like, when they start trash talking or they say something, or then they slap them to disrespect them, and then the crowd reacts to it right there. And I think that's what it is. It's like kind of what, as opposed to what you're saying about like crowds trying to get themselves over or this and that. It's like the crowd's just there, and they're kind of playing along the role that they're supposed to. They know when they're supposed to cheer, but then they will kind of just stop and be quiet and let the match do what it's going to do, so they can react the right way. So I think that's where the crowd was really impressing me. Was like, the time they were quiet, and they kind of allowed certain things to happen.
But I think that lends itself to, at the same time, that the U.S. crowd, they don't get matches. They don't get matches like that. I mean, I think wrestling is afraid to do that type of match in the U.S. because they're afraid of the reaction. They're so worried about ratings. But there's no matches like that. I mean, give us a chance to watch a match and let's see how we react. I mean, all we know is that, you know, all we know is you know, Cesaro and John Cena is a perfect example. And I don't want to get back into it again. But, you know, the second that someone does a big move and kicks out, then some hump up in the stand, you know, up in the bleacher says, "This is awesome." And everybody starts following suit. It's kind of I mean, the whole thing is WrestleMania. We're there at WrestleMania and Lesnar and Roman Reigns, you know, it was kind of everybody's booing Roman Reigns because that was the soup of the day is to, you know, is the clam chowder of the day. It was the roasted vegetable of the day to boo Roman Reigns. But then the second that Seth Rollins comes out, we're sitting here and we're pretty quiet. We don't know what's going on. I mean, we know what's going on, but for the first time, it's like it's not predictable. And we don't know what's going to happen. And, you know, because we can even say Seth Rollins comes out and we're going like, ah, shoot, you know, Seth Rollins is going to throw away his money in the bank. He's not even going to win the match. There was kind of something there. So when he finally does win, we're sitting there and we're going crazy because it's something that we haven't seen before. You have a match like this with Neville and Chris Jericho. I want to see matches like that. I mean, you look at any match that's in New Japan Pro Wrestling. Let me look at those matches. I mean, even, you know, like last week they had New Japan Pro Wrestling. They're doing the G1 Climax, right? So they do like four. They do four matches, you know, back to back, and they're cutting matches here and there. Every single match was good. I mean, the Carl Anderson match versus here we go again with me falling flat again. But Carl Anderson was facing a guy that versus Okada, right? You don't think Carl Anderson is going to beat Okada, but then he beats him. And you're watching this maybe like a 6-minute segment, and you're sitting going like after he beats him, it's like, man, I really wish I could have seen the whole match because what I saw was really good.
Yeah.
I mean, do those type of matches in the U.S. And the one thing, and I want to talk about Baylor and Owens as well. Talk about how a guy like with and remind me because I want to bring this up later on with Kevin Owens, but like Finn Baylor's entrance. I mean, I hated it. I mean, it just felt like the boogeyman, you know, and it just was really bad. I don't like Finn Balor's, you know, sprayed body. But what gets me out of it real fast is Baylor starts off fast and does like three or four moves really good, and then it becomes a Kevin Owens match. And all of a sudden, I don't see the body paint anymore on Finn Balor. Now I can get past his stupid ass gimmick, and I can actually watch a match because they allowed that match to develop as well. And I thought Kevin Owens was really good at terms of being the heel. I think you had a case where you had a really good heel in Chris Jericho. The heel wins the match. With this match, you have the heel in Kevin Owens, and he loses the match. I think Finn did a lot of things. Like kind of going like, you know, because with Finn Balor, you know, you hear all this stuff about Finn Balor, right? And you're like, well, what is it about this guy? Mm-hmm. And then he doesn't do high spots just to do high spots. There'll be times during the match where you're sitting going like, you know, so what is it with this guy? Why is everybody on jocking this guy so hard? And then he does a move, whether it's a kick or he does something off the top rope, and then you're sitting going like, oh, that's why. Mm-hmm. Like now I get it. And it's like, and you slowly get invested in this guy. The only problem I really had, I think, was. At the end when he won, I think he played up to the crowd just a little bit too much. It was kind of a case where, you know, before he did those, you know, before he did the drop kick to put Kevin Owens sitting down in the corner. Yeah. Then he walks away, he kind of turns to the crowd, puts his arms up, and then he does that crazy drop kick, which I have no problem with him doing that. But it's like, dude, I'm like, you don't need to do that. You don't need to play the crowd. Just go out there and kick ass because I think people like that a little bit better. And it's just like a small, minute thing. I'm picking at straws with this guy. But Finn Balor put on a great performance. Kevin Owens was great as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think he's going to do a little bit more playing to the crowd, being that he's in Japan. I think that's a very special experience for him to do. So, you know, no beef with that at all. I'm gonna partially agree. With you on his entrance, I'll tell you the things that I like and then the things I don't like. I don't like all the crawling. Maybe he could do a little bit of it, but it just takes way too long, to be honest. Like the hair thing and the arm, like kind of tassel thing, I think looked super corny. I like the face. I like the paint. I like the body paint.
I like the Oni demon on his back. I mean, yeah. That was good.
That on his back is good. The whole kind of Carnage type thing's good. I really like the music. I like the entrance music. And I like how he times the thing where, like, it has that kind of point where the music rises.
Yeah.
And then he does a thing where he leans his arm back and the crowd can get into it. So I think there's a lot of really good stuff about his entrance. But, like, if I was going to pick at it, I'd speed it up a little bit, especially with the crawling stuff. And then
these aren't even problems that we have.
Right.
You know, I mean, the guy, over the course of that whole match, you forget about everything else.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just saying, like, that's where I would. So there's certain things that I think you're right about.
I mean, what I wanted to say was you know, I'm not a big fan of his body paint, but then during the course of the match, I'm sitting there looking and going, like, you know, this guy has it.
Yeah.
I mean, body paint or no body paint, the body paint works for this guy because he does it in the ring.
Yeah, yeah. And I think of all of the kind of gimmicky things that he's doing, I think the body paint is the least of the worries. I think if there's other things that are kind of on top of the body paint that you're going, yeah, this is a little too much. It's like all these freaking hats with, like, all this stuff on the bill. You know, just give me a nice hat with, like, something in the middle that I can work with, right? You don't need all that other shit. In terms of in the ring, yeah, he's a really good performer. He brought back, you know, I've seen a lot of the high-flying stuff that he's been doing in NXT. But what I liked is he brought back his like, Bloody Sunday, that kind of, like, elevated inverted DDT. Mm-hmm. Which I haven't seen him do that in NXT yet.
Yeah, I think he did that because Japan. I mean, that's.
But I think he should be doing that a little bit more. I think that would be my one gripe with him in the ring is they're making him a little bit too much of a high flyer. I think too many people are doing the double foot stomp. I really liked it when Senshi was doing it about 10 years ago, and it was kind of like a novelty act. I don't think I don't know if anybody else was really doing it, but now it's like everybody and their mom does the double stomp, and it's a fine move, but I don't think that. And I think he did it really well.
I think he does it well.
I think he did it really well, but I would go to something else as a finisher.
Well, it was I don't mind him doing the double stomp as his finisher. The problem that I do have, though, is that I don't think he does two double stomps in the U.S. You know what I'm saying? I mean, in Japan, you can do your finisher multiple times, and it's not so much as...
U.S. is getting... U.S. is at point now, man. I mean, Cena kicks out of a minimum four... finishers. I think Cesaro kicked out of an AA. I mean, kicking out of a finisher is. I mean, that, and I think that's part of the problem. That's one of the problems with wrestling today is the devaluation of legitimate finishers. But I think he does do two in the U.S.
I think if the storytelling is done well, and I think Owens and Cena, that first match, them kicking out the finishers. It worked at that time. I mean, because in terms of flow of the match, it wasn't time to end the match. And I think CM Punk and John Cena kicking out the finishers, I thought that worked as well. Cesaro and John Cena, I don't want to get into, especially after the whole attitude adjustment off the top rope. I thought that was a really bad way to end that match. What I liked about the Finn Balor and Owens match is when Baylor first did the double stomp. I'm kind of sitting there going like, well, it's not time. I mean, but at the same time, if he won off of that double stomp, I would have got my money's worth. I'm like, if he won off that first double stomp, I'm like, wow, that was a great match. But I think it's a case where Owens kicks out, and I'm like, oh shoot, I'm like, we got some more, you know, there's some more going on that match. I want to watch more of this match. I'm glad that he kicked out. He does the second double stomp. It's like, yeah. And it's like, sells it. You know, Owens sold it both times. The second time, it's in terms of the progression of how everything happened, it made more sense for him to win it that time. And it's just that lack of storytelling, I think, that's in the U.S. ring that, you know, you're just kicking out a finisher just to kick out, and you're just doing high spot after high spot without any kind of chain of moves to lead up where it doesn't work, but it works here.
And to that point, I think that the Bloody Sunday really set it up because that could have got a finish right there. And I think once that level of damage was dealt, then he was, as a gorilla would say, he was ripe for the pickings. And then when that next double stomp came, then you know it was viable that was the one that does it.
So here's I told you to remind me about Kevin Owens, which you didn't do, but luckily. I'm on my game tonight. Actually, I'm not. I think I'm sucking this podcast right now. Is Owens the guy to kind of bring back storytelling in wrestling, at least in U.S. wrestling? I think with this guy does enough little things, even after the Finn Balor match, where you should. I mean, the time was right for, like, a handshake in the middle of the ring, right? And I like how Owens didn't roll out of the ring and just walk away. He's sitting there and everything. I mean, that's his title. I mean, that is his title. Mm-hmm. And even though he hasn't held the title as long as some of the other guys, I think Neville's held it longer. Yeah. That was like Kevin Owens' title. It was his title. He owned that title, and he lost it, and it actually meant something when he lost to Finn Balor. And Finn puts his hand on the ring, and you're kind of sitting there going like, well, two things are going to happen. And either Owens is going to kick Finn Balor's ass, which isn't going to happen because you know that even Owens in that match, you knew that his mind was on John Cena. And he didn't. The announcers didn't have to tell me that. I mean, just what Owens does, Owens walks by some guys wearing John Cena stuff. Right. And he tells that. He extends that part of the story. You know, so the second that he does that, you know that John Cena's in the back of his mind, right? Mm-hmm. And you know that Owens is going to come out and say the reason why he lost that title is because, you know, his real sight's on John Cena. So either Owens is going to kick Finn Balor's ass, which you know he's not, because storyline-wise that's not going to happen, or he's going to turn and walk away and not shake his hand. But there's always that kind of small kind of chance that Owens can redeem himself, and then he plays the chicken shit heel and walks away. I wouldn't say he's not a chicken shit heel.
Seth Rollins is doing a great job of being a chicken shit heel right now.
Owens is just a straight up heel. And so what I'm asking is that from what you've seen Owens in the ring, and I'm not talking about wrestling wise, I'm just talking about persona. Is he the guy that can kind of bring back storytelling into wrestling? And can he ever do it, or do you think he's going to be held back doing that as well?
I mean, I wouldn't see why they would want to hold back storytelling. So, I mean, I think he could be. I think there's a lot of guys that are there that can tell a really good story.
Will he be allowed to bring back storytelling in wrestling? Because yeah. I don't think any of these guys are allowed to.
I don't know. I think that there are guys that are really good at doing it. I think he might just be better at it than a lot of the other guys are. I mean, I think...
Well, who are these other guys?
I mean, I think Rollins tells a really good story. Let's see. I'm not, I'm level right here.
I'm going to draw a picture of... I'm going to put it on top of the wall and say, Kevin, better have my donuts. Don't look at me. Don't look at me.
Right here.
Don't be Mahmoud Abdul-Rauf. Don't touch me. Don't touch me. I don't know you. Don't touch me.
Yeah. Like, you know, I think depending on what the match is, I think Big Show has come a long way of telling really good stories. You know, Reigns, that might be one of the weaker points in what he's doing. And I think Ambrose tells a better story than he actually wrestles a match at this point. That's no slight at Dean Ambrose. I like him quite a bit. But I think his storytelling intrigues me more than like his moveset and the things that he actually does. I think there's a lot of good storytellers.
But I'm talking about going against the grain of what we're used to.
Going against the grain is a different question. But yeah, I think Owens could be the guy.
Well, it's not a different question. I mean, what's your idea of storytelling right now? I mean, I'm talking about like being able to not toe the company line and tell a different story in the ring and have me actually like you without the company telling me that I'm supposed to like you or hate you. Can Owens be the great storyteller? How about that?
Yeah, because I think if you're going to say who's the guy that brought it back, you might be able to give it to Bray a little bit more, but I think that
I'd give it to Punk. I'd give it to Daniel Bryan.
Okay.
And I think Seth Rollins when he was with the Shield, mm-hmm. the way his mouth that what he used to say in the ring and stuff, just mm-hmm. the way he would just like yell at the referee and stuff.
Yeah.
That and then but he's not doing it anymore. So.
But I think that Owens. What can I say? Like he has all of that and he has that ability. But I think the whole thing is. I mean, it really comes down to Cena, right? It's like, it does.
I know it does.
Because it's like, there's been opportunity after opportunity for, you know, however many years. These guys come, you got all these guys that can really, you know, they have a ton of potential. They're built in the right way. And then you put them up in a feud against Cena, and then you basically throw it all by the wayside. And right now he's 1-1 with Cena, and with something at stake going forward, like it would send a good, it would send a clear message, like, you know, this is a guy that we're going to build, because like everything that you could say about the build of Owens right now, you could say Bray Wyatt 2 years ago, and what's Bray Wyatt done since he's got done feuding with Cena? Now he's done a lot of good things, had good matches. I still like Bray Wyatt quite a bit, but in terms of where you saw, you're like, when he was having that feud, you're like, pretty much everyone's like, in 6 months, this guy could be a world champion. Mm-hmm. And he's just been stagnated, like Raekwon said. And this could be a tipping point here with Kevin Owens. It's like, is he going to keep progressing and being a guy that you're going to build your company around? I mean, he very easily could and probably should be the number one badass heel.
I think he is. I think he is right now, if they allow him
to. Right, well, yes. But if he loses this match, and then he goes into Rusev mode, then there's nothing again. It's like Rollins is the number one heel right now, but he's a chicken shit heel, and he's a damn good one. Okay, but they don't have a monster heel that's legit right now, and Owens, it's all there for Owens to be the guy.
The Owens and John Cena feud is the first good John Cena feud I've seen. Probably this side of maybe Edge, but I don't even think Edge and John Cena was a real feud. I mean, I think
that was a pretty good feud.
Well, I mean, but how long ago was that?
Like 10 years ago,
yeah. Right? I mean, this feud right here, this is the first feud with John Cena, and you're not talking. I mean, you're to borrow from Ric Flair, you're in some high cotton when you talk about quote unquote John Cena feuds. You're talking about the top guys in the business. You're talking about The Rock. You're talking about CM Punk, but I don't think CM Punk and John Cena was really a feud. I think they would dust it off every now and then when they wanted to switch titles around and everything, or set someone up to lose a title. This was like the first one, because Owens is one of the guys that can cut through all the BS. Right, he can cut through all the garbage that John Cena is saying. He can come in and pretty much put down John Cena without trying to put him down, by just like telling the truth. Or just really kind of extenuating what his character is supposed to be. He doesn't try to compete John Cena with the corny put downs or whatever it was. And that was a problem with The Rock and John Cena feud, was that they were trying to trade barbs, and John Cena couldn't hang, and The Rock was going down to John Cena's level by doing that. Where with Owens, you know, John Cena is doing his playbook. You know, John Cena 101, promos 101. It's like, okay, first I'm gonna be all quiet and be all heartfelt, and next week I'm gonna yell, and then the yelling kind of got some reaction. So guess what? The week after that, I'm gonna yell again. Kevin Owens comes in, says the same thing over and over again. Every time that John Cena is cutting a promo, you're thinking of Kevin Owens in the back of your mind, going like, well, he said this last week, and people are eating it up. And then he comes out again and does the exact same thing. I mean, like, he's like the antithesis of what John Cena is supposed to be, and John Cena's stick does not work on Kevin Owens, because John Cena, I mean, I think Kevin Owens right now is really speaking for people like you and me, and is actually getting some type of push where he's not being discredited, you know, by losing all the time against John Cena. And you're right, this match, I think this match is probably going to be the biggest match the WWE has had since CM Punk left.
In terms of impact,
yeah. I mean, what happens here is really going to dictate how I'm going to watch wrestling, how the WWE universe is going to be. And I think it has a lot to say about what John Cena's legacy is going to be. I think if John Cena loses the belt to Owens, because we're sitting here going like, well, who's John Cena going to, you know, when he first won the U.S. belt, we're like, well, who's John Cena going to lose to? I'm like, we're glad that the U.S. belt means something. But the funny thing is that the U.S. belt really hasn't meant anything until Owens came into the picture. And all, you know, now Owens saying that he wants that belt. Now that belt means something. But we're saying, like, well, who is he going to lose to? Who can he lose to? Who is he going to put over? Kevin Owens is a perfect guy to put over right now with that belt. He doesn't have to be the top guy. But the second that you put that belt on this guy, he has legitimacy. The second that he becomes U.S. champion, now all of a sudden he's a part of the program. And he's part of Raw right now, but he's always had the NXT thing going on as well. And the whole thing is, I think he's done great on both sides. He's done great in WWE. He's done great in NXT as well. And it's Kevin Owens has been the perfect, everything that they wanted this guy to do in terms of building up the NXT brand, building up building up the belt in Raw. He's been doing. I mean, he's taken care of NXT. He's allowed NXT to get kind of mainstream pull. He's the first NXT champion where you're sitting there going like, this guy is just as good as anybody else. He had these other champions like Zayn. Like, I like Zayn, but Zayn was always like, it's in the background, right? Like, NXT was kind of like, it was kind of like the quiet kind of stepchild's wrestling show, right? All these people were like, NXT is really good. It's like, well, I don't have time to watch NXT. Well, Kevin Owens is making me watch NXT because I want to see what this guy can do. He's brought NXT, I think he's really pushed NXT to the forefront, and he's doing the exact same thing in Raw. He's over as all hell, and I really think that if he loses against John Cena, I think it's not only is it a big mistake, but I'm probably going to stop kind of not watching Raw as much and probably start watching NXT because that's where I can watch real wrestlers. I already have New Japan Pro Wrestling. I think New Japan Pro Wrestling has totally changed the way I watch wrestling, and that's what I'm watching more now. I look forward to every Friday. I look forward to watching.
Yeah, I was pissed last week when it was a replay.
Yeah, well, it wasn't. They had the climax, the four match
replay climaxes. Of the climax from the week before, though.
No, it was all new because they had four matches. It was Nakamura versus what's his name? Who's the guy that Kurt Angle fought, the Japanese guy in TNA?
Nagata.
Nagata, yeah.
I think it came on later or something like that.
Yeah.
I remember.
Yeah, they show the replay and then they show the new one.
All right, yeah. Cool. Yeah, I got
yeah.
it.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, it was fun seeing Yuji Nagata wrestle again.
It's fun seeing Yuji Nagata do a job for someone, you know? I mean, let's not get into that right now, but I mean, what do you kind of think about this whole Owens and Cena match? Even how I've went on and pretty much stated my opinion now.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think there's nobody on the horizon, except for possibly Finn Balor, that you could say in the next 2 years could become, like, a major star in WWE, right? If you're looking at their developmental, and obviously this is going to depend on if they can sign guys, or who they sign and this and that. But it's basically, after Balor and Owens, like, it's kind of dry in NXT, I'd have to say. So,
well, you got Samoa Joe, but Samoa Joe, I think he can be there for a year. You got Zayn's hurt.
Yeah, Samoa Joe is great, but like, so it's already pretty well established what Samoa Joe is, right? They're not going to take him up, I don't think, and like give him some big push to be the world champion. But what I'm saying is, like, if Owens doesn't come through and beat John Cena, then there's no person on the horizon that they're gonna bring out and say, like, this is the guy that's gonna take the spot, unless it's Balor. I think Owens is more likely to do it than Balor is. Just the physical matchup seems like it makes a lot more sense to me.
I think right now what they have is they have, in Owens, they have a future world champion. And I never thought that, looking at Owens, he does not look like a world champion. But what the guy has done, his body of work that he's done, and he's done more in 2 months than a lot of people have, that a lot of wrestlers have done for the past 3-4 years. The sad thing is that you had guys on the roster like a Ziggler. I mean that's the other thing too, is like, you have Ziggler and Bray Wyatt just like kind of hanging out going like, wait a minute, like, these two guys, you could have made a case where you could have Bray Wyatt be the world champion, and you could have Ziggler be the Intercontinental champion, and have these two really strong champions. I'm looking at it now, it's like, would I have a problem with Owens being world champion? I think Owens right now should be destined to be the world champion. And I really think that Finn Balor should be, he's a perfect Intercontinental champion. You put those two guys with those belts, all of a sudden, what the WWE used to be in the 80s and stuff, with the biggest draw in terms of personality or charisma in Kevin Owens, and in straight worker. And the thing about Balor is that Balor has the it factor too. But then I look at like guys like Bray Wyatt. I look at guys like Dolph Ziggler, and then Seth Rollins, and then you throw Roman Reigns into the mix, and then
Brock in the mix.
Yeah. So I mean, throw all those guys in the mix and let's go with it.
Yeah.
But what are they doing? You know, they're
revolving dusting the whole show around John Cena.
Yeah, and John Cena, and then Kane and all that stuff. Yeah. So that's what it is. Should we be happy and say something happy at the end?
I don't think that's negative. I mean, I think what we're saying is there's a lot of directions you could go. There's a lot of talent in that company.
and there's a lot of different guys that could do things that, you know, could carry this company going forward for the next 5+ years. It's all there for them as long as they, you know, make some reasonable decisions.
The fanboy in me is coming out again, and I say you draw out Seth Rollins. You know, Brock Lesnar, Seth Rollins, that's an intriguing matchup as well. Yeah, I don't know what's going to happen there, and that's a good thing. If Brock wins the belt, I don't have a problem with it, because I think Brock, I really think I've come around on Brock. I think he's the biggest draw in wrestling, and you can even look at the Beast in the East. I mean, you look at what he did in Japan, and just being who he is, and it's like, that's a draw. I mean, I'm not tired of him kicking someone's ass. Sometimes it's slow and methodical, but you're sitting and just wonder at this guy, going like, wow, this guy's really good. The funny thing is, I didn't even watch the main event, the tag team. I was like, all right, I don't need to watch this. Yeah, so I didn't watch that. But the whole thing, the fanboy in me is going, okay, you know what? If Brock wins, that's fine. But you know, let's do something where either Roman Reigns turns on, or Dean Ambrose turns on Roman Reigns against Bray Wyatt, or maybe in the Roman Reigns match, you bring back the Wyatt family. I would much rather see that. You bring out the Wyatt family where they help him beat Roman Reigns. Roman Reigns asks for Dean Ambrose's help, and somewhere down the line, like, Dean Ambrose turns on Roman Reigns, and you're going like, oh, what the heck's going on? And then during that whole mix, then you have SummerSlam with Triple H versus Seth Rollins, and the Shield reforms. So you have the Shield back in the mix. You have the Wyatt family back in the mix. Now you have Kevin Owens. Balor can come up, you know.
Whenever.
Yeah, he can come up in 3 or 4 months. You still have Ziggler in the mix. You still have, then you have Bray and the Wyatt family back in the mix. New Day is still there. When Tyson Kidd comes back, you have there.
That's going to be a while.
Yeah. When the Usos.
But you got Cesaro hanging out there.
Yeah.
With something that needs to be done.
Something, yeah. And the Usos, where I don't have to hear Jimmy just butcher the mic like he did on that one. That was bad, dude. It's like come on, dude, whatever. But that's the whole thing. Like, you know, that, I think that's why we kind of watch wrestling, is to say, like, you know, all this stuff can happen, and whether it does or not, but there's a slight hope that it can happen. And like I always said before, they have enough guys where they can do a lot of things.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It's just kind of sad if that doesn't happen, but at least I have New Japan to watch.
There you go. Yeah. I mean, I think the roster's deep. I mean, there's a lot of stuff they can do with it.
To end it, like, what do you feel about R-Truth, dude? What he's been doing the past, you know?
I'm pretty much ignoring it as much as possible.
He's not coming around to you at all? Because I'm kind of coming around to that guy, dude.
No, and worse yet, it's the same old stuff with Wade, right? Now he's got to lose to R-Truth every single week. I just don't understand. I don't see the point.
He beat R-Truth.
What, after he lost him, what, 3 times in a row? I mean, it just...
At least the Muppets weren't involved, dude.
Right, you're right, dude. The Muppets weren't involved. So. Okay. Yeah, I guess it was better than I thought.
Okay, good.
So yeah,
as long as you're coming around. So let's get into Golden Mike real fast. The reason why we picked this particular Golden Mike will be pretty self-evident.
Chris Jericho, Rock. In just a few moments, you guys will meet each other, determine the number one contender for the WWF Championship. And the winner will get a shot Thursday night on SmackDown against the champion, Kurt Angle.
Hold on one second, Mitchell Cole. This is not an interesting situation. This is Raw! Is Jericho! And what that means is...
Finally, The Rock has come back to Boston! You know, The Rock says that tonight's the night.
Uh-oh. I don't give a Brahma bull's ass what The Rock has to say. You with your unibrow and your just bring it. Bring what? A vomit bag? A Fig Newton? Or how about a Y2J telling you to shut the hell up? Because all that matters is tonight, Y2J will become the number one contender for the WWF.
So let The Rock understand this. Y2J, tonight, you actually think that you're going to become the number one contender for the WWF title?
No, not just think.
It doesn't matter what you think!
The only thing that matters is to...
No, Rock. You're wrong. The only thing that matters is that I've tasted WWF Championship. And I know what it tastes like, and I love it, and I want it again. And the only thing that matters is that the coffee-fearing Kane is not in this arena to spoil my chances. And the only thing that matters more than anything else is the fact that every single Jerichoholic in this arena and watching at home wants to see the WWF Championship around my waist again. If you smell... What Y2J? He's cooking.
Oh my gosh!
Smell what Y2J is cooking? You ask the Rock to smell what you're cooking? Well, let's just say, for argument's sake, that the Rock does indeed smell what you're cooking. Because the Rock will try anything one time. So here it goes.
He's smelling.
Ah, yes, there it is. Indeed, the Rock does smell what you're cooking. And quite frankly, Chris Jericho, what you're cooking smells like 100% grade A, money back guarantee, one big bucket of Canadian moose piss. You see, Chris Jericho, you come out here and you run your mouth about how you've tasted WWF gold. But the fact of the matter is that The Rock has lived WWF gold. And The Rock will be putting it down on anybody who stands in his way. So whether it's you, Chris Jericho, Chris Jericho's daddy, Chris Jericho's mama, Uncle Joe Jericho with the glass eye, or maybe it's Grandpa Jimmy Jack Jericho with the iron lung, or hell, it might be even Grandma Jezebel Jericho with the double X dirty panties. The only thing that matters, Chris Jericho, is we have one big family reunion. You bring them all so The Rock can take his hand and lay it to smack it down on all their candy asses. And what you fail to realize is this, Chris Jericho, when it's all said and done, all the dust has settled, all the smoke has cleared. And The Rock is done whipping that candy ass. And The Rock goes on to become number one contender for the WWF title. And The Rock goes on to become WWF champion. You, Y2J, and the entire Y2J family will never, ever be the same again.
So sometimes, like last week, I think there was a debate on whether it was going to be a golden... or a rusty, or whatever. Like, there's no doubt this is a golden mic. And both Jericho and The Rock are gold on this one. that's how you build a match without, like, you know, matches and run-ins and this and that. Like, you can take... It's been a while since you've had two guys that you could just take there with a Rudy Pooh, like Michael Cole, sitting there holding the stick.
Yeah, making his eyes all big
with his frosty tips, yeah. and just have two guys sit there and go back and forth verbally. Every line's good, every line's money, and build a match within like 5 minutes. You could just like, I want to go watch that match right now, right? Just from watching those guys talk for 5 minutes, and that's what's great for me personally. I like the Rock, my personal favorites in this promo were. The Rock will try anything once, and the 100% money back guaranteed moose piss. I think that's classic right there. And this is like Rock at the height of his powers. So I think those two guys, they always played well off of each other. I think it was just money, and I like the promo.
I thought it was okay. I mean, yeah, I think it's one of those cases when you see it the first time. And they did stuff that you never saw before in terms of taking each other's catchphrases and stuff and everything. What I really liked about the promo is that it really put Jericho on equal footing with The Rock, where The Rock was pretty much untouchable on the mic. Jericho was a very, very close second, and there was a couple times where I think Jericho would actually beat The Rock. And what this promo established was these guys going back and forth. They've done way better ones than this one, but this was kind of like the first one that they did, where they would kind of banter back and forth, and then they became like they started respecting each other, and they and you realize they started having fun with it, and then everything they did when both of them were on the mic, it was must see TV. So I thought it was okay. I mean, and I think it's just Jericho was getting his chops, and once it's not like Jericho had to get his chops, but within the WWE universe, he had to get his chops against guys like The Rock because he's never promoted a guy that could outtalk him. The Rock could outtalk him, and then what it slowly started to become was that both these guys had, you know, would put each other down, and it was equal. And then when they had a common cause, whether it was Stephanie McMahon or Booker T, then that stuff was gold. So, you know, I brought up Jericho on this one because I think Jericho is one of the most underrated guys on the mic, but also probably is one of the most underrated characters too. A lot of people don't give Jericho credit for the characters that he was. I mean, he could play a really, really good heel. I mean, you can't even call him a chicken shit heel because
he could.
He was. Yeah. I mean, that's what I'm saying. But I think if you say chicken shit, it kind of demeans it a little bit. I mean, he was just like he played the chicken shit to a T, and he really kind of. He made his own heel character off of that, and that's what I really liked about the Neville match was he was doing his typical heel stuff that people identified with, and you're kind of sitting there forgetting like, man, Jericho was really good. I mean, Jericho, I think that the past couple of years that Jericho's been back in the WWE, I think he's been tarnished a little bit because he hasn't been allowed to really kind of be as creative as he wanted to be. I mean, I think the closest one he had was when he was doing with CM Punk, but that one was kind of a shtick. You know, it was kind of like, hey, how's your sister? You know, I mean, it was kind of like he could get away with it because he's Chris Jericho, but he's better than that.
Right.
Yeah, and this is kind of what he was. But when Jericho first came into WWE, he was doing the stuff that he was doing in WCW, and I think he was on all cylinders, you know, in terms of that type of heel, and then he had to evolve as a heel. To kind of fit a heel in the WWE style, and I thought he took off of that as well.
Yeah, and I think, like, the thing that you really like about this is, like, kind of looking at the promo we were looking at last week, like, the way that he evolves over time. Like, this was, like, your typical early 2000s type of promo. But the guys, there's few guys that could do it like that, right? Today, you can't. You don't have guys that can do that. It's way more scripted. You can tell, like, I'm sure there was a script that they were working off somewhat there, but a lot of that was kind of free flowing. And the thing with you're saying, like, The Rock, you know, like in today's day and age, if you had a guy that could speak as well as The Rock coming in and cut a promo, they'd probably say, well, you can't be that good because you can't be that much better than John Cena or whoever it is. Whereas back then, it's like, well, if you're going to cut a promo like this with The Rock, you know, you better be up to it. Because if you're not, The Rock's going to embarrass you. And I think there wasn't maybe, I'm not a huge Foley fan, but he might be the only other guy that could. And I like the way Jericho did it a lot better. But there's only a couple of guys that can maybe get in there and banter back and forth with The Rock.
Austin was one because, not because of what Austin said, but because Austin had so much crowd support,
right.
And Austin was good on the mic too, don't get me wrong, right. But his was definitely more staged, and it was kind of, he had to hit the points, you know, like he was the bread and butter of what the fans were, mm-hmm. Where The Rock could be who he was, and over time people started accepting, went full on with The Rock, and Jericho became that way too, and seeing that's kind of the problems that I have. I mean, because you have some people say that, you know, The Rock, you know, is a brown noser with Vince McMahon and had to do a lot of stuff and just kind of kisses a lot of ass. But, you know, the whole thing is, The Rock paid his dues as well. And I'm not even talking about Rocky Maivia, but I'm talking about like this case right here, you know, like making Chris Jericho
into a superstar,
not something more than he was because Chris Jericho had it, but having allowing Chris Jericho to realize what we all knew all along. And so that was kind of like the whole thing was, you know, you talk about this promo where the WWE took WCW guys and put them where they belonged, what we thought they could be. And it wasn't the big stars. There's guys like Chris Jericho. There's guys like Eddie Guerrero. Chris Benoit was the same thing. It's like when they finally started getting their runs and stuff, it's like, you know what, this has been a long time coming because everybody sees it. I just don't know what happened to that. I don't know why, I don't understand why that isn't the case now. So it might be turning the corner, I don't know. But yeah, good goal, Mike, all the way. Instead of doing Hall of Kayfabe, unless you have a guy that's overwhelmingly won, I want to do something because you brought up last week's Golden Mike. I don't think you have an appreciation for Bruiser Brody. So you're off. You're off for the summer. I want to give you some homework. And anybody else, you know, that's listening, I want to give you some homework and watch about 3 or 4 Bruiser Brody matches. And then maybe listen to maybe 4 or 5 Bruiser Brody promos. And let's talk about them next week, because I think I wanted to put this guy in the Hall of Kayfabe, but you've never seen this guy, so you can talk about him. But Bruiser Brody, I think, is one of the... You talk about Japan and the U.S. Bruiser Brody is like one of the... I think he's the mold for just like what you don't see in wrestling anymore. Is like a guy that was really big in Japan. I mean, the reason why he died was because he didn't want to lose in Puerto Rico because Japanese media was there. He wouldn't do the job for Cologne or whatever. It wasn't Cologne, but it was maybe someone else. Mass Invader or whatever it was. Invader number one. I don't know. But you're not giving him his due. So do some homework on Bruiser Brody. Let's talk about him next week.
I did some homework this week, actually.
On who?
I went back and I watched Steve Austin, Bret Hart, WrestleMania 13.
After we talked about it?
Yeah, and since I've been off, I've been listening to a lot of podcasts, a lot of Stone Cold podcasts. Okay. The Chael Sonnen podcast is actually really good too, by the way.
Yeah.
But yeah, just that was.
Let's go ahead. Let's go ahead and let's talk about that match.
So it's funny because I've heard a lot of.
Have you seen that match before or not?
I don't know if I've ever watched it all the way. I think I've seen highlights of it, but I think I've never sat and just watched.
I bought you the DVD, man. It's on your Bret Hart DVD that I bought you for Christmas that one year.
Well, then I did see it before then.
Okay.
I think it's because now I've got a more of an appreciation of Steve Austin, just from listening to his podcasts and other podcasts where people talk about him and whatnot. But like he's always talking about how like when he was younger he was like really athletic and a really good worker, but I think it was after maybe the neck injury or something kind of like reduced it to kind of stay healthy. And I think that's most of my memory of Steve Austin is like that Stone Cold, the reduced in the ring guy, still a good worker. But he looked like really spry and athletic in that match with Bret Hart. The side of him that I
just crazy. He looked crazy.
The side of him I don't.
He was skinny and you know.
And I don't ever remember seeing him like that. In like the times when he's fighting The Rock and stuff like that. So that kind of like struck a chord with me. Like, you know, this guy, he really was like. Like was a real true mechanic in his time when he had like all his physical faculties with him. I thought the match was.
Wasn't he a guy that you just never saw before? I mean, during that match, and that's the thing I took away from that match, because I saw him. I was lucky enough to see him doing small matches as well. But the thing that
Stone Cold, or are you talking about back when he was like Stunning Steve?
No. I mean, I saw some Stunning Steve stuff. I mean, you know, I'm talking about when he first started that Stone Cold character. Because what I remember was. You know, I was kind of watching wrestling here and there. I wasn't really interested in it. And then Stone Cold cuts that promo on Jake the Snake and just all, you know, there's all this buzz about how he just shot down a legend. Like, you know, it's like supposed to be a feel good story, but basically like Stone Cold just poked a hole in that whole, like kind of, you know, Jesus or, you know, John 3:16 and stuff, because the guy was still on drugs. I mean, give me a break. But the WWE was trying to say like, oh, Jake the Snake found himself, and the guy, he was fat, he was overweight, it's like, what the hell is this? And Stone Cold just kind of, cut through all that BS, right? Mm-hmm. And so this guy just has a big buzz, and they start kind of doing, like, small vignettes. I think there's, like, the Olympics, and, like, Stone Cold has a shot put, and some guy's, like, running a marathon, you know, he's, like, running and talking about, like, the American spirit, and Stone Cold, like, just kind of, like, is walking, he picks up, like, the shot put and just, like, chucks it, doesn't even know, he just throws it because it's in his way or something, and it hits the guy in the head in the marathon, and he's, like, passed out and stuff. So it's just, like, small stuff like that, but all I remember is, like, this guy coming down to the ring, for that match, and you just watch this guy like, man, this guy is going to blow up. I mean, there's no way this guy can keep up the same intensity the whole flipping match. Yeah. And the thing is, I saw some matches leading up to that, and I remember just going like, who the hell is this guy? I'm like, I've never seen a guy this intense, this like 150% throughout the whole match. And then when he's done with the match, he notches up to like 200% and cuts this promo, and you're just sitting there like, you're like tired by the time he's done. And I just remember him just...
Steve Austin's wearing you out.
Yeah, I mean, in a good way. Not, that's a good thing, not a bad thing. But, I mean, what's your kind of... What was your take when you see this guy walk... what was your take watching this guy? Because you saw him for the first time with what he was talking about. What did you take away from that?
Like I said, the thing that I took away mostly was just, like, how athletic he was all the different variants of what he could do in the ring, right? It's just a lot more entertaining, like, in-ring performer than I remembered him being from the other things I saw. It's like, yeah, I'm used to him coming out with all that fire and stuff like that. So that I was kind of used to, like, the energy level and whatnot. But, yeah, just he worked really well. Him and Brett both worked really well
how?
In the match.
Tell me how. I mean, it's like, this is like the Ricky Lake show or something. You're like some guest on the, you're like somebody in the audience on the Ricky Lake show. Telling them to kick the man to the curb. I mean, what was it about the match? I mean, tell me, dude. Come on, you're a broadcast journalist over here, dude.
Like, there's no like specific spot. It's just like I'm used to just seeing him stomp people, like and throw punches and hit his spots. I don't know.
Paint me a picture, dude.
I can't paint you a picture.
Put the afro on, do the happy little trees like that dude used to do back in the early 80s and 70s
and
stuff.
Handlebar.
Yeah. It was a really good match. Hey everybody, Stone Cold and Bret Hart, that match, it was really good. And Ben had my nose, he really liked it. I really liked it.
You heard it here first.
you're killing me, dude. Come on, man. So that's the other homework too. I don't want you to tell me like that you thought it was really good. Of course it's really good. I mean, what was like your impression, dude? I mean, come on, man. Break everything down, like, and just get to the bare minimum. What'd you get out of that whole match?
Get out of it? I just knew... Well, it's hard to say, because, like, I already knew what point he got to, right?
Try.
I already knew, you know, that by the time I'm seeing this match, you know, the Stone Cold Austin story is pretty well written, right? I mean, I'm thinking if I would have seen the match and not known, like, where he was going with it, it would have probably blown my mind, right? Now I'm just looking back to just see, let me just watch it. But yeah, I would have been surprised, especially just seeing a guy like him that had been kind of mid-card for so long to all of a sudden just come out with that, and like, yeah, I'd be like, where'd that come from? But I didn't see any of the build-up, so I'm just watching it, you know, as like more of a Bret Hart guy. I've always been a Bret Hart guy, but kind of, like I said, I've been kind of listening to so much Steve Austin. It's just something like, you know, this is a match that, you know, I should really see, because, you know, it's kind of like the turning point for in a lot of ways in wrestling at the time, and you know, I think, I don't know, you can kind of see why. Bret Hart does what he does, and you always say, like, you know, he's got his moves and all his spots, and there's like a Bret Hart type match, which it kind of was, but like, you know, Steve Austin matched him in every bit, so it wasn't like watching old Bret Hart match necessarily. So Steve Austin still, like, he definitely I'm not gonna say just like he got his stuff in, but I mean, like, there was a physical element to that match that generally you don't get in a Bret Hart match.
It was a Bret Hart match. I mean, it was a Bret Hart match through and through. What made that match so good was you had this guy in Steve Austin, where it was this pacing of a Bret Hart match, and you saw it over and over again. And the product is a good product. I mean, a Bret Hart match is a good match, but every time that it could have just been another run-of-the-mill kind of big-time match that never lives up to it, right? Like, you have, like, the pay-per-view as the payoff. Every time it seems that it's going to go in that direction, Stone Cold was able, for me, about 10 or 15 seconds, just go off the deep end and just put his body out there. I think they were on like a turnbuckle, and I think maybe didn't he wrap a rope around Bret Hart's neck, or
it was like a extension cord.
Yeah, so just little things like that where it was at that time it never really happened, and here you have this guy in Bret Hart that does just a straight technical match. With what Austin coming in every like 15, 20 seconds, just he threw a wrench in that match every single time. Like every time that Bret was going to start doing the pace, and I'm not talking bad about Bret. I mean, Bret, his idea of a wrestling match, that's what a wrestling match was. I mean, that's what a wrestling match is supposed to be. But for every 15 or 20 seconds, after an interval of like maybe 2-3 minutes, Austin would just do the stuff that you never saw Bret Hart. He was never in that situation. Yeah. And it forced Bret Hart to elevate himself up to kind of get on Stone Cold's level, where all of a sudden Bret Hart is being taken out of what he does and what he usually does in a match. He has to go toe-to-toe with Steve Austin, and you're sitting there going like, well, wait a minute, like, this isn't Bret Hart's match. Bret Hart can't match the intensity that Stone Cold does. And over the course of time, Bret Hart gets down and dirty. He busts Stone Cold open. He puts him in the sharpshooter. Stone Cold passes out. And it was just kind of the thing, like, Stone Cold had the whole heel mustache going, right? He didn't even have the goat going. He just had a straight mustache. And you're going like, dude, like, what the? I mean, this guy looks like a flipping goof. But the whole thing is he just goes balls out the whole time. And you're just sitting there watching this match. And you don't know what to think about it. I mean, you really sit there, and you're going like, why do I like this match so much? And when you're done with it, you're just like, what did I see here? I mean, what was this match? All I know is that it was good. I enjoyed watching it. And Bret Hart, it's like Bret Hart did everything that he's supposed to do. He rose above his competition. He was able to force his will on Steve Austin. But at the end of the match, who really won this match? It was Stone Cold that won the match. And you're kind of sitting there at the end going like, well, what am I supposed to like here? Am I supposed to be happy that Bret Hart won? I mean, Bret Hart had a great match. But Stone Cold, it's not like Stone Cold stole the show. I don't think he stole the show. I think it was kind of equal footing that both these guys did it. But you don't know what to think after this match because you've never seen that before. You've never seen so many wrenches thrown in a Bret Hart match. And it was something that I never saw before. It's like this skinny, wiry guy that was just going 300% the whole flipping match. And by the time you're done with it, you're just sitting going like, how am I? I'm like, I remember at the end, I was like, what am I supposed to, what am I supposed to get out of this?
Yeah. Well, I think like there was a lot of guys like, they fell into a category where it's like you had kind of like some of your hardcore guys, and then you had your technicians, and there wasn't too many, if any, that like could kind of work both sides of that fence. And I think that's where this Steve Austin match is really unique, because it's like he had that really physical element, but then there was a technical side to him, and that was kind of I think more than anything, like I didn't probably articulated that well, but like I was struck by the technical side of Steve Austin that was what stood out to me the most, is the technical side of Steve Austin. And then he still had like a lot of malice in there with like all these different things that he did, but that was, I've seen him do that, right? But this was kind of like that combination, and I think that's probably where it was probably really interesting and fun for Bret Hart, because you could have the elements of that type of match that he hadn't done. But you're still doing it with a guy that's technically sound, so he knows like where to go and what direction it's all headed in.
Yeah. Two technicians. You had the.
You don't think of Steve Austin as a technician.
Well, yeah, and you don't. And this what I'm trying to say is that you had the picture. You had the definition of a technician in Bret Hart. I mean, Bret Hart is a technician through and through, and he faces a guy like Austin who is a technician, but had that, I like that malice, and he had that wild side to him. He just had, I said like throwing wrenches, but he was this guy that would just go off the deep end. And then Bret had a kind of, the whole thing is you're sitting there and you're hating Steve Austin. You're like, man, like, God, I hate this guy. And then Bret starts, fighting fire with fire. And you're going like, dude, I'm like, I don't like Bret Hart. I mean, like, God, I'm like, this isn't Bret Hart. This isn't the Bret Hart that I'm used to seeing. And you kind of get mad at Bret Hart a little bit, going like, why are you going down to this guy's level? And Bret Hart, you can never do it as good as Steve Austin does. Like, nobody can do a Steve Austin match that he's doing. But Bret Hart started doing it, and it's kind of like what Tanahashi does a little bit in New Japan, what he's doing now. It's like he's kind of, there's a little bit of malice in Tanahashi, and they haven't really fleshed that out. There's like little snippets here and there, where with Bret Hart, you always kind of knew Bret Hart was like, I mean, Bret Hart was such a poster boy. And the whole thing, but you felt like it was kind of an act, you know, because he did play the heel way back when. And you're going like, man, like you're shaking these kids' hands, you know, you're putting sunglasses on these kids and stuff. You're like, man, like, I hate.
How do you really feel, Bret?
It's like, I hate you, Bret Hart. And that was like the best thing. Like with Austin, he's all black and pink ties. Like, what the hell is that? You know, and so you have all this stuff, and then Bret Hart starts doing all these heel type things, and you're sitting going like, dude, I'm like, I don't like this. I'm like, I don't like this Bret Hart. Like, I don't like Bret Hart anyways, but I really don't like this Bret Hart. And slowly,
And then you ended up liking that Bret Hart.
Well, yeah, and then I do. But I had my preconceived notion of what Bret Hart was for the longest time. That match didn't change my perception because I never liked Bret Hart. But that match, really, I was like, I finally, people can kind of see what I've been kind of seeing. And then I watched that match probably 5 years, when I bought you the DVD, I watched that match. I'm like, man, I hate Bret Hart. I can't stand this guy. Like, Austin's doing all the work again. And then people kind of talk about the match. And then I listened to Bret Hart being interviewed in some podcasts. And he kind of talks about, the way he approached stuff. And then I watched that match again. I'm going like, wait a minute. Both these guys are doing good things. Bret Hart, we should go with, like, when we say John Cena, when he has a good match, how much of that is John Cena? How much of that is the other guy? And we usually say it's like, 30% John Cena, 70% the other guy. This one was like 101%, 101 Bret Hart, 102 Steve Austin. And you can watch that. I can watch that match tonight and go, well, Bret Hart, I think, really made that match. So it was just kind of that whole back and forth thing where both of these guys gave their all. And it's very easy to say, well, both of them gave their all. But there was so much character change during that time. And you want to talk about, a guy like Bret, a champion, allowing a guy to take off. Well, Austin took off. We all know where Austin came. And the whole thing is when, after that match, I remember watching Austin with The Rock on just like a regular Raw. And just sitting there going like, and I remember watching Rock and Austin fight and have a match. And it was kind of during that time where it was kind of a throw between WCW and Raw. And I remember that match watching Austin and Rock and saying, you know what? I'm a WWF guy now. I'm like, WCW, I'm going to watch WWF now from now on. WCW is going to be in between commercials. I'm like, I'm WWF all the time because these guys are going 150% where WCW wasn't. But what it allowed to do, too, is that Bret Hart became one of the best heels in the business during that time after that match. So this match, you even talk about like just the actual, and I think I'm glad that you re-pontificated what you said. You actually said why you liked that match. You did it a lot better the second time, and I had to slap you around after the podcast like I usually do. But we're gonna come up on something, so hold on. A bitch, nigga. So, yeah, I mean, that's pretty much where I come from with that. So, and the little glitch we had just kind of took me out of my element. But, yeah, I think that's a match you can always come back to. And I think over the course of time, that's probably one of the, I don't want to say what, maybe top five matches of all time, you think?
Could be, yeah. I mean, it's up there.
Yeah, I mean, it's probably one of the, I mean, I don't think it, I think people, like, I always say, like, what are the best matches I've seen. That's not a match that I sit there and go like, well, this is the best match I've seen. But in terms of what it did for the business, I think it's one of the most important matches probably ever.
Right. I mean, because it launched Stone Cold, who ends up being, arguably maybe one of the top guys that there ever was. And then it launched a guy like Bret Hart, who, was legendary at the time, but was maybe getting a little bit stale and needed a character change. And then
long in the tooth?
Not even that, because I think he probably had, if not for Goldberg, he probably had another 10 years of wrestling in him. but gave him like a depth to character that he never had before, or at least put him into that direction of having him with that kind of that second run of the Hart Foundation and being like the Canadian hero, and I think that was the right time for it.
Yeah, it's not a Ricky Steamboat match. It's not Macho Man versus Ricky Steamboat. It's not Ric Flair versus Ricky Steamboat. But in terms of everything, in terms of like a storytelling match, where it not only did it end a feud, but it really bolstered the careers of the two guys involved. I think it's a huge match, and you know what? To tell you the truth, it's a turning point. I think that match, if I want to say it, I think that match saved the WWF. That's the match that saved WWF from WCW, because I was watching a lot of WCW, and WWF was just really kind of cookie cutter. It was just really bad. Same stick over and over again. This match put WWF back on the match. If that match doesn't happen, we're watching WCW right now, and we're listening to Tony Schiavone. So, and Don West. Oh my God! Oh my God! Power slam! Oh God!
Call me in the next 15 minutes. I only got 25 of these left.
He's on pace to hit 800 home runs in one season. Oh my God!
You gotta get your hands on it now.
Yeah, it's not even licensed by MLB. It's like there's like some picture where they airbrush the logo out. Oh God! Look at this red jersey. Oh God! All right, the Muda scale number. I don't even know because we have the last episode. So I haven't been able to put on Muda scale number 116. I got my boy. Better have my donuts over here. I apologize for calling you out on that match, but it needed to be done. It's for the greater good. So better have my donuts over here. I'm Bad News Ramen. Anything else you want to say to all your fans?
No, I don't.
Okay. No. That was good, yeah. Okay, work on that. All right. Muda scale 116 and we're up.
And also in the set from Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, we got my man J-Ru the Damager. Yo, tell him why you're the man.
I'll tap your jaw. You probably heard it before. Step to the Bentlemite. I prove my word is law. Drugstore with more. Don't rhyme Vendor. Not far shoot to beat the chief ambassador. Niggas get mad cause they can't score. Like a Wild West flick, they wish to shoot up my door. But I incite to riot. Don't even try it. Bust up chunks of crab kids. Keep quiet. Like I said before, I tap jaws, snatch whores. Kill suckers in wars. Pick a style you said was yours. Money grip, wanna flip, but your fish. House the mic like your hooker and did tricks on a bitch. Dirty rotten scoundrel, and my name is J-Roo. Utilizing my tools in 92. MC step up in mobs to defeat us when we rock knots and got props like Norm Peterson. Lots of fun, lots of fun, lots of beers. Got the skills, Greeno, so I always get cheers. Troop on like a trooper, no tears but fears. I'ma get mines cause the crew will get theirs. Cut you up like Edward Scissorhands. You know the program, I'm the motherfucking man. Fucking man. Fucking man.